Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 62. My name is John. I'll tell you right now, any trick in the book now, baby, that I can find, Superman or Green Lantern, ain't got nothing on me. This is predominantly a political podcast. It's me ranting about things that bother me as I read the news and listen to commentary month in and month out. That isn't to say that politics are always on my mind. In fact, sometimes I do everything I can to get my mind off politics completely. Let's be honest. I'm a libertarian. And that is tantamount to Andy Dufresne chipping away at his wall, handfuls at a time, for half a lifetime, and then crawling through a river of shit just in the hopes of coming out clean on the other side. Dealing with politics can be aggravating when you have clowns to the left and jokers to the right. So I have my happy distractions. First and foremost on that list are comic books. Now, don't be afraid. I did a comic book themed podcast almost a year ago, but as you'll recall, I brought it into a political point because that's just what I do. Even the Super Bowl podcast I did had a little politics thrown in at the end. So, while I could talk comics and some sports pretty much every month, I won't do it here. But in early April, I read a couple of interviews of comic book creators, and it got the gears in my brain turning. The first interview was with Darwin Cook. A little background here for those unfamiliar. If you were to say the name Darwin Cook around a comic book fan, especially one who favors DC comics like me, you will likely hear in the response, New Frontier. New Frontier was a 6-issue miniseries written and drawn by Cook and released in 2004, and it was very well received by both readers and critics. The story has the familiar DC characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Flash, but it's set in the 1950s with a retro art style. There was a direct-to-video animated feature released in 2008, and it does an admirable job translating the material, but I highly recommend the source material because, well, the book is always better. So Cook has been known since that series as a throwback creator. And after reading this interview, I kind of understand why people think of him that way. When he was asked about his place in comics, he said, I think there have been a lot of real tactical errors made in this century. I can't really read superhero comics anymore because they're not about superheroes. They become so dark and violent and sexualized. I think it's a real wrong turn. I don't know how a company like Warner Brothers or Disney is able to rationalize characters raping and murdering and taking drugs and swearing and carrying on the way they do, and those same characters are on sheet sets for 5-year-olds and pajamas and cartoons. I think there's a really odd and schizophrenic thing that's happened within the industry. Everybody's writing books for themselves. The median age of a creator is probably between 35 and 50 right now. Once they abandon the notion that these characters were all ages characters, they really limited the market. I think the bravest and smartest thing one of these companies could do would be to scrap everything they're doing and bring in creative people who would have the talent and were willing to put in the effort it takes to write an all-ages universe that an adult or a child could enjoy. If either one of these companies were smart enough to do that, I think they could take huge strides for the industry. I can't say that I agree with Mr. Cook here, and not just because in the same interview he bemoans the fact that DC Comics only wants him when they do a retro-style story. Why is it okay for a company like Disney to take a story like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, strip it of all its pathos and adult themes, and turn it into a silly, shallow, homogenized cartoon that, frankly, is garbage compared to the original work. But a character like the Batman, who in his first appearance remorselessly lets a criminal die, must be restricted to an all-ages accessible story. Just an aside to pile on to this idea. Back in the late 1980s, when Tim Burton's Batman movie was in development, and news about the actors and the style of the film was getting out to the fans, my then-friend's brother came back to town to visit. He had been living in California for several years, trying to get work in the movie business, and according to his story, he knew Burt Ward, who played Robin in that old 60s campy Batman television show. He talked about how the actor was upset that not only were he and Adam West not considered to act in the new movie, but also that Burton's vision of a dark, brooding Batman was not what the character should be. My friend's brother then went off on a short rant about how Ward was right. See, he grew up on that TV show, so that's what he thought the character was supposed to be. I was into comics at that time. The Joker had recently beaten the current Robin in the comics, a kid named Jason Todd, to death with a crowbar. Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns, one of the seminal comics of the era, had taken the character to new heights. But more so, I had also had the chance to read some early Batman comics as well, like the first appearance I just mentioned a moment ago, where he was a brutal, noir character. So my friend's brother's rant made no sense to me. If anything, the cheesy 60s show was the anomaly. But the fact is, there's a place for all interpretations of the character. Of course these characters can have adult stories that appeal to grown-ups and cutesy milquetoast stories that appeal to children. That's not schizophrenia. That's intelligent marketing. When you have characters that work on several different age and maturity levels, it makes sense to have things like the old Batman TV show or the recent Brave and the Bold cartoon for kids, while Scott Snyder's current run in the comic books and Christopher Nolan's movie trilogy can be geared toward older teens and adults. Creators like Darwin Cook and Alex Ross and others who tend to create stories set in the past to honor the good old days may say that their stories reflect a more wholesome, simpler time. But was it? What was the price of the innocence? The second interview was with DC Comics co-publisher Dan DiDio and Lynn Wein, who was a very influential writer and editor at DC Comics. The interview focused on the 1970s when Wein was doing some of his most familiar work. The 70s were a time of change in the comic book industry. Characters that were once solely geared towards children were now dealing with deeper matters like civil rights and drug abuse. So what changed? I think it was a combination of several things, Ween said. Not the least of which, that the Comics Code changed. Some of us will remember the Comics Code Authority. Yes, some of us will. But I'm going to guess that perhaps my listeners don't. So let me get you up to speed. Back in the 1950s, a man named Frederick Wortham was on a crusade for what he felt was the deterioration of morals among the youth of the day, especially the boys. He studied the situation and concluded it was due to those young males reading comic books. Of course, when someone wants to place blame, he, she, they will make sure their findings fit their hypothesis. So he looked through comic books and found some shadowy images, which were obviously naked women, something decidedly immoral for boys in the 1950s. Superman was a fascist, and that was un-American. Wonder Woman was strong and independent, so obviously she was a lesbian. And perhaps most famously, he considered Batman and Robin to be homosexuals, because what else could they possibly be? Despite the fact that he intentionally misrepresented his research, he published a book titled Seduction of the Innocent. Sounds ominous, doesn't it? He stirred up enough fear and panic in the hearts of 1950s America that the Senate held hearings on the matter. There was widespread public concern. Now, about 30 years previous to these hearings, the modern degradation of our individual liberty began with the onset of the personal income tax. About 10 years previous, the next huge step was taken as the Roosevelt administration weaseled its way further into private business and eroding more liberty in the guise of a strong America. So, government of the 1950s was just giddy with all the good they could do, so long as the fearmongers stirred up enough panic so the politicians could proverbially ride in on their white horses and save the day. The pressure from the supercilious government officials and their vocal constituents made it clear that they were going to fix this problem with these evil comic books. So comic book companies had a choice. Feel the wrath of the pious crusade for wholesome childhood entertainment, or self-flagellate to a point that those self-righteous warriors accept the comic book company's contrition and leave them alone. So they narrowly escaped regulation of the government by creating their own regulation entity, the Comics Code Authority. Here is the code as it was originally presented in 1954. Crimes shall never be presented in such a way as to create sympathy for the criminal, to promote distrust of the forces of law and justice, or inspire others with a desire to imitate criminals. If a crime is depicted, it shall be as a sordid and unpleasant activity. Policemen, judges, government officials, and respected institutions shall never be presented in such a way as to create disrespect for established authority. Criminals shall not be presented so as to be rendered glamorous or to occupy a position which creates a desire for emulation. In every instance, good shall triumph over evil, and the criminal shall be punished for his misdeeds. Scenes of excessive violence shall be prohibited. Scenes of brutal torture, excessive and unnecessary knife and gunplay, physical agony, gory and gruesome crime shall be eliminated. No comic magazine shall use the word horror or terror in its title. All scenes of horror, excessive bloodshed, gory or gruesome crimes, depravity, lust, sadism, masochism shall not be permitted. All lurid, unsavory, gruesome illustrations shall be eliminated. Inclusion of stories dealing with evil shall be used or shall be published only where the intent is to illustrate a moral issue, and in no case shall evil be presented alluringly, nor as to injure the sensibilities of the reader. Scenes dealing with, or instruments associated with, Walking Dead, torture, vampires and vampirism, ghouls, cannibalism, and werewolfism are prohibited. Profanity, obscenity, smut, vulgarity, or words or symbols which have acquired undesirable meanings are forbidden. Nudity in any form is prohibited and is indecent or undue exposure. Suggestive and salacious illustration or suggestive posture is unacceptable. Females shall be drawn realistically without exaggeration of any physical qualities. Illicit sex relations are neither to be hinted at nor portrayed. Rape scenes as well as sexual abnormalities are unacceptable. Seduction and rape shall never be shown or suggested. Sex perversion or any inference to same is strictly forbidden. Nudity with meretricious purpose and salacious postures shall not be permitted in the advertising of any product. Clothed figures shall never be presented in such a way as to be offensive or contrary to good taste or morals. Now that you know what the Comics Code entailed, let me continue with Lynn Wein's comments. That was really a lot of it. A lot of things that had not been permitted before the Comics Code, which came in during the 50s, and it really led to the Batman vs. Alien stories that you got in the 1960s. By the 1970s, we were doing stories that we felt needed to be told, and occasionally the Comics Code Authority would say, "That's lovely, but you're violating the code. You can't do that." And eventually, guys like us and Stan Lee finally said, "If that's going to be a problem, screw you. We're going to do them anyway, and we'll just do them without the Comics Code Authority." And the world didn't come to an end. And we started to do more and more. So, let me underscore the timeline here. The self-regulation of the industry came about because of pressure from the self-righteous in society and the federal government in the mid-1950s. That's when things got decidedly campy. Because it is so silly and so sanitized for the youth of the day, by the time ABC decides to develop Batman as a television show, all the source material is strictly for children. In the 1970s, the same idea drives the creation of cartoons, but the need to infantilize it is so bad that they can't even call their group of heroes the Justice League of America like they do in the comic books. Now, they call them the Super Friends. And that is the nostalgia that current comic book creators like Darwin Cook and Alex Ross champion today, and people like Burt Ward and my childhood friend's brother misunderstand as the original material. But it's all phony. It is unnatural because the regulation forced the industry into a place it may not have naturally gone. As Lynn Wein said, in the 1970s, as popular opinions began to change, the creators found ways to work around the Comics Code, and eventually, if they got to a point where they couldn't pacify the code, they published their work without the code's blessing. As these more mature stories proved their popularity, and as writers pushed the proverbial envelope, the industry began to realize the code was no longer needed. Marvel Comics abandoned it in 2001. Surprisingly, DC was the next to last to drop the code one day prior to Archie Comics putting the final nail in the coffin. So, again, the code comes in during the 50s. For about 20 years, an entire generation, the industry publishes books and characters geared toward children, and that extends to other media. In the 1970s, cracks start to appear, and writers get a little bit more mature in their offerings. By the time the 80s roll around, some stories don't even bother with the code before they're published. And yes, if you're familiar with comic books, you know in the 1990s, things get a little bit crazy with over-the-top characters and some heavy violence. And by the turn of the millennium, most people realize the code was a bad idea whose time had not only passed, but should never have been. I want to repeat a line from the Darwin Cook interview about comic books today. He said, "They've become so dark and violent and sexualized." No. They've gone back to being dark and violent and sexualized. They were that way before regulation, and now that the regulation is, for all intents and purposes, gone, the natural form of the media is back. It's the campy, cheesy, sophomoric stories of the comic code era that are the lie. It's only through forced regulation that these stories unnaturally came to be. And just as an aside, just so we don't think that this puritanical mindset is completely gone, the code stated, "Females shall be drawn realistically, without exaggeration of any physical qualities." The idea being that women should be portrayed as wholesome and chaste. Recently, some fans expressed great displeasure at a variant cover of the Spider-Woman comic book that had her in a very suggestive pose in her tight costume. The artist, known for provocative female poses, had his work removed because of the backlash. The problem with the complaints is, though, Spider-Man has been shown repeatedly in similar poses throughout the years, and there was never a complaint about that. So, part of me wonders when this will cycle around again, and companies will be forced to censor themselves if a pose upsets the delicate sensibilities of fragile psyches. It seems to me that the undertone of Darwin Cook's interview is that he would gladly outlaw mature, explicit, and violent stories in favor of a force story that is accessible to all ages. Would some of these creators really be so nostalgic for the good old days if they understood why things were that way? If the Comics Code were still followed today, there would be no Walking Dead, because those are specifically outlawed by the code. There's no Winter Soldier movie, because that shows disrespect for government officials. There's no History of Violence or Road to Perdition movies, because those glorify criminal activity. You see, not everybody is aware that Walking Dead, History of Violence, and Road to Perdition are all based on comic book stories. That's what regulation of the comic book industry gets you. A bland, sterilized pap that is sweet for nostalgia or immature minds, but just doesn't cut it when you fence in the creators. What is done in the name of protection only mollycoddles and prohibits innovation. And yes, you can apply that same concept to all other forms of regulation forced upon us by an overbearing government or by an industry regulating itself under duress from the government. Candy bar companies are decreasing the serving size of their products. Are people clamoring for a smaller Snickers bar? Are they intimidated by the size of your average Zagnut? No. The nanny staters in government are pressuring them just like the comic book industry was pressured in the 1950s. The candy companies are self-regulating themselves and making smaller candy bars so government won't punish their businesses. And whenever government is stepping in to solve a problem, you must look into the history to find out what the government has already done that caused the problem. Where was government playing favorites that gave certain companies an unfair advantage? What did government regulate that caused unintended, well, for the sake of argument, let's call them unintended, consequences, and eventually caused more problems down the road? What laws did government pass that stifled innovation or kept competition from improving the market? What business that enjoyed being the pets to government officials are deemed too big to fail and given taxpayer money to prop up their poorly managed company? Comic books, candy bars, real estate, infrastructure, energy companies, auto manufacturers, airlines, healthcare, net neutrality. It would be easier to try to write a list of areas where government doesn't try to regulate, and we'd be damned hard pressed to figure any of them out. But we will blindly allow our politicians to play their games in Washington, stuff their pockets with profits from their insider knowledge of the game that they can fix to their desired outcome, and foolishly trust that they have our best interests at heart. It is a sick irony that people clamor for regulation because they think the government will prevent evil businessmen from conning the masses out of their hard-earned money. That's what government does to us all the time. I've said it before and I'll say it again. You'll probably hear it yet again in a podcast a few months down the road. I was speaking with a businessman a while back, and he was talking about how regulation was necessary in his line of work to keep people honest. So I asked him if he would cheat his clients if there weren't any regulation. "Of course not," he said. "I want to be known as an honest guy who does things right." "Okay, well then, do you know of any other people in your line of work who break the rules?" "Ah, yeah, I know a bunch of guys who do that." So if you would do the right thing, regardless of the regulation, and the bad guys will do the wrong thing despite the regulations, what good are the regulations? A business has wronged you, not delivered on their promise of goods and services. Take them to court. That's why we have a judicial system. That's one of the few things that our government is supposed to provide. If you eliminate the favoritism the legislative and executive branches have given businesses, then the judicial system will realize they can't play favorites either. I know. What was it I said earlier about chipping away at a wall for half a lifetime and crawling through a river of shit? Well, hey, that river of shit is the product of generations of people fooled into believing that if they don't like something, they can